Welcome to Farmed and Dangerous, a long-term memory radio series on the pharmaceutical industry in Canada. Today we discover how hot news stories of medical research breakthroughs in the mainstream media and prestigious medical journals are actually unpaid advertising for big drug interests. We also look at the health risks of highly touted gene therapy drugs already on the market. And we take a closer look at rules governing clinical trials of these new drugs. The question is, are there any rules? Our guests are Dr. Diana Zuckerman, President of the National Center for Policy Research for Women and Families in Washington, D.C., and Colleen Fuller, consumer advocate in the area of prescription drugs and author of Caring for Profit, How Corporations Are Taking Over Canada's Healthcare System.
Every day in the mainstream media, we see reports of exciting breakthrough therapies and promising new miracle drugs. But the stories often fail to mention that the experts touting the miracle cure have financial ties to the product. In the October 2002 issue of Extra, the magazine of FAIR, the Media Watch Group, Dr. Diana Zuckerman published an article entitled Hype in Health Reporting, Checkbook Science Buys Distortion of Medical News. Dr. Diana Zuckerman is president of the National Center for Policy Research for Women and Families, and she's speaking to us from her office in Washington, D.C. In your article, you use the expression checkbook science. What does that mean?
I coined the term checkbook science to refer to the fact that so much research is really bought and paid for in a way that's not immediately obvious to the public. People have heard of junk science, which is actually a term that corporations coined so that they could criticize research that they didn't agree with. And frankly, a lot of corporations responded by buying science and by buying research that would support their point of view, and that's what I call checkbook science.
Tell me, true or false, is the medical news we see in newspapers unpaid advertising or not?
A lot of times it is. Of course, it isn't always. A lot of times it really is unpaid advertising. Somebody has actually paid for it, but it's not the usual advertisers being paid for it. It's just not so obvious who's paying for it.
But how does it work? How does this media coverage happen?
I guess we shouldn't actually call it unpaid advertising. We should call it secretly paid advertising. The way it works is that a company might buy research that asks questions in such a way that it'll make their product look good, whatever their product is. And this is very often true for new breakthrough drugs and other medical products. Basically, they pay for the research. They sometimes even pay honoraria to respectable university faculty members, even sometimes medical school faculty members, who loan their name to a paper that they may not have written and may know very little about. Many corporations will pay for research that they want to be published. So, for example, they might pay for researchers to do a study which asks questions in a particular way so that it'll be sure to get the answers that they want. So, for example, rather than comparing a new drug to placebo, a sugar drug, they might compare it to another drug on the market which actually is no better than placebo. And that way, they can say that the results show that the product is just as good or better than some other product on the market without ever admitting that their product is actually no better than placebo, a sugar pill, which is no treatment at all. And so they'll pay for the studies. They'll sometimes pay honoraria to university faculty members or medical school faculty members to lend their name to the study. That might help them get it published in a major medical journal, or they might publish it in another kind of medical journal that looks exactly like a real medical journal, but is also basically bought and paid for by companies whose products are being written about in the journal. And then they will send out press releases to all the media outlets, newspapers, magazines, and radio to make sure that everybody knows about this great new medical breakthrough. And so from start to finish, from the study itself to the press release that describes the study, every part of that is really bought and paid for by a company that is trying to sell you the product, but the producer of the TV show or the reporter who writes about it for the newspaper might have no idea at all that there's all this money behind the study. They might think it's a legitimate study showing a genuinely effective new drug.
So you're saying that newspaper personnel, editors and reporters, journalists, they're not up on the fact that, for example, these new medical journals may have been created entirely by public relations firms.
That's right. It really isn't always obvious. First of all, of course, most journalists are not scientists, so they're not very well trained to ask the kinds of questions about the quality of the research or the quality of the science. And then there are so many different medical journals and so many different scholarly journals that most reporters wouldn't know whether one particular journal, as long as it had a good name, had a name that sounded legitimate, they wouldn't know that that's what's called a throwaway journal. There are these journals that are basically not subscribed to. Physicians don't subscribe to them. They are just provided for free, because they basically are a form of advertising, provided for free for every physician, and they get them. And they're called throwaway journals because a lot of doctors just throw them away.
What about the top-of-the-line prestigious medical journals like the New England Journal of Medicine, British Medical Journal? How many articles, to your knowledge, are bought and paid for by pharmaceutical interests?
Nobody knows, and that's, of course, part of the problem. Certainly, those are well-respected journals, and they do the very best they can to ask authors about potential conflicts of interest. That's one of the requirements that they have. Of course, if authors don't disclose it, usually they would have no way of knowing. And sometimes even the people reviewing these journals do have conflicts of interest that also are not necessarily disclosed. So they might have, very often do have, in fact, financial relationships to some of the companies involved because they get consulting fees or other kinds of fees or honoraria from those companies. So although these high-prestige medical journals do their best to make sure that the research published there is good quality research and unbiased, it's virtually impossible to control all of the bias and all of the financial ties.
In your article, you mentioned some examples of PR-driven medical reporting, such as diet pills and breast implants. Would you like to talk a little about that?
Sure. Sometimes this information comes out in depositions during lawsuits or in other ways. A lot of times that's about the only way we'll ever find out what's really going on. And because of that, in some famous court cases involving Fen-Phen, the diet drug, and also in some cases involving breast implants, it became clear that research that was being widely quoted and that was published in legitimate and sometimes prestigious medical journals was actually bought and paid for, just as I described, bought and paid for by the companies who had something they wanted to say. So, for example, when a company is being sued, as the breast implant manufacturers were and as the makers of Fen-Phen were, when the companies are being sued, it's certainly in their financial interest to find some researcher somewhere who will conduct research to prove that their product isn't really so dangerous, is safer than people thought. Even if they can't get research to prove that it's absolutely 100% safe, if they can at least get researchers that will call into question how dangerous it is, they can save millions or even billions of dollars in lawsuits. So it's part of their strategy, and what they have found from internal documents and from depositions in these court cases is that this research can be absolutely a part of their legal strategy as they try to cope with lawsuits from people who've been harmed by their products.
Now, you've done a lot of research into breast implants. The most important research studies receive no coverage at all. Why not?
That's another sad twist on this, that when the companies pay for the research, when those studies come out, those same companies hire high-priced PR firms to make sure that every reporter in the country knows that their study has come out and showed that their product is safe. But when the federal government did a much better study, did several much better design studies, which were of women who had had breast implants for at least 8 years and some as long as 15 or 20 years, and when they found that there was a higher risk of certain kinds of cancers among women with breast implants, and in another study they found that women were more likely to die from certain respiratory diseases or from suicide if they had breast implants, and in another study found that a lot of women had broken implants that were leaking and the women didn't even know it. But because those studies were conducted by the federal government, which had no financial interest in publicizing the studies, those studies got almost no attention at all. They were picked up by a couple of reporters here and there. They weren't on the front page of any newspaper. I don't think they made it to most TV station newscasts or too much radio coverage. And that was the end of it. So the studies came out. They were very briefly covered and easily forgotten.
There was news of a significant hormone replacement study that broke in the media in July of 2002 that revealed the true dangers of this therapy. And you say in your article that most media covered this story as if it were enormous news that came out of nowhere. What was really going on?
Many of us who had looked into this issue realized that there had been studies published for years, at least a couple of years, that made it very clear that hormone replacement therapy wasn't nearly as beneficial to women and might actually be quite dangerous for some women. And so there were several years' worth of studies published in major medical journals showing major research that women taking hormone replacement therapy really were not doing so well, were not doing better in terms of heart disease, as everyone expected, and in fact were doing worse. They were clearly at higher risk for breast cancer. There were a lot of negative findings, but it was really the same situation as what happened with breast implants. Because the manufacturers of hormone replacement therapy didn't want to publicize these results, which showed that their product was not so effective and might even be dangerous, there just wasn't very much attention to these studies. So they're published in medical journals. Obviously, not that many people read medical journals. And even if they do, they might not remember exactly what the study showed. And there was no one who was paying a PR firm or anybody else to publicize these findings. And so they just never saw the light of day until finally this largest study, actually a huge study funded by the U.S. government, was stopped for ethical reasons. And that doesn't happen that often. And so that made a huge splash, and suddenly the media was paying attention to an issue that, you know, I only wish they had started paying attention to at least 2 years earlier.
There was no PR machine getting the press coverage happening.
That's exactly right. And actually, something else is happening just now. This happened since I wrote my article. Just in the last couple of days, a new study came out in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that lumpectomy, which is the removal of breast cancer but not the entire breast, showing that lumpectomy is just as safe as mastectomy, which removes the entire breast, for most women with early stage breast cancer. And again, this is information that's been around for a long time. Actually, in this case, this information has been around for more than 15 years, and a lot of people do know it. But still, it happened to come out in a prestigious medical journal, and so fortunately, it is getting a lot of attention, and that's a very good thing. But I promise you, if there were people who were trying to sell this idea the way they try to sell hormone replacement therapy, this would be something that would have been in the news constantly for the last 10 years instead of occasionally, once every 10 years or so, there being some media attention. So it's the same kind of thing. Unfortunately, sometimes the most important research gets very little attention because it's competing against other research that is being heavily, heavily promoted by certain financial interests that are trying to sell you or me a product.
Now, you mentioned prestigious medical journals. There are also reputable newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. It's hard to believe that they would bow down to science in that sense, that the image of science would be so huge for them that they would fall in with drug industry agendas so easily.
Well, I don't think it's their intent to do that, but I think that most reporters, unfortunately, don't ask these crucial questions of who paid for your research. And frankly, even if they do ask the question, if the person is a reputable researcher at a medical school, the assumption is that the research is solid, well-designed, and objective, because the assumption is that no medical school faculty member would lie about research findings in order to make money. We'd like to think that's true, that, of course, nobody would do that, no doctor would do that, but unfortunately, the truth is different than that. There's a whole paper trail showing that there are, in fact, some doctors and some other scientists who will put their name on articles describing research that isn't exactly accurate, and sometimes the person whose name, you know, the author, doesn't even realize that the research isn't exactly accurate.
Have you ever wondered whether drug company promotion includes buying into newspapers or news organizations directly?
Huh. Well, look, if you look at magazines, just about any magazine, you'll see that there are ads for certain products that pharmaceutical companies make. So, for example, if you look in women's magazines, they are full of direct-to-consumer advertising for diet pills, for pills that are supposed to lower cholesterol, for anti-depression pills, for breast implants, for a wide range of medical products that they are trying to sell to you. And it is then not too surprising that those same magazines are unlikely to run any stories that question the safety of any of those products that are widely advertised in their magazines. So that is one of the ways that pharmaceutical companies and other companies help control the news articles and feature articles about their products, and of course also help inspire some very positive news coverage in those magazines, because if the advertising is helping support the magazine, there's just going to be a reluctance to criticize that. And I've been told that by reporters and editors when I've talked about certain products that are very questionable. You know, they've told me off the record that because their magazine advertises those products, it would be very difficult for them to run a story that's critical of them.
You mentioned a while ago one essential question that media editors, reporters doing stories on pharmaceutical issues might ask, which is, who funds your research? Who pays for your research? Are there any other questions they need to ask?
Sure, because it's not just who funds your research, but do you have any other kinds of financial ties with the company? You know, sometimes it's right there. For example, the New England Journal of Medicine does require those kinds of conflicts of interest to be listed. And I have seen examples where the first article, let's say it comes out in the New York Times, that frequently happens, where the New York Times article on some new breakthrough medical product will have, towards the end of the article, that the person who did the study is a consultant to the company that makes the product, or that the research was funded by the company that makes the product. That's very, very common. But then other newspapers or TV news might pick up the story, and they'll run more or less the same story, but they just won't mention that part. And by the time, you know, your third-tier news organization is running the story that they picked up from someplace else, you can pretty much bet that piece of information just won't be included. So there's a lot of ways that happens. But the other thing I think that's difficult is that because so many clinical trials, so many studies of a new product are, in fact, paid for, at least in part, by the company who's making the product, it's pretty hard to know what to do about, you know, should you not cover any of those stories? Well, that would be one option. But news media outlets do want news stories. They want stories on health products. And if they were to limit their stories only to studies that were conducted without any funding from pharmaceutical companies, for example, they wouldn't have a lot of studies.
They could label them as advertising.
They could do that. That would be nice. But, of course, you know, the reporters feel like they're doing a good job. The reporters feel like they're doing a news story. I've seen this happen where somebody does a story that is absolutely dependent entirely on some PR machine that's promoting the story, and the reporter is completely unaware of it. You know, they'll even say to me, oh, no, that I didn't pick that up from promotional materials. I just heard about it, and then I called the company. Well, you know, how did they think they heard about it? They heard about it through some clever promotional efforts that got that information out so that people were hearing, so-called hearing about it.
Any other comment on the presence of pharmaceutical industry interests in the media?
Huh. Well, you know, I just think that it's very unfortunate how much research on new products is done by people that have ties to the companies or by the companies themselves. And it would sure be terrific if governments were more generous in funding unbiased research conducted by people who don't have those ties, so that they could really tell us, those of us consumers and patients who might want to use these products, tell us objectively how effective is this product or not. And it's very difficult when you have a lot of new products coming out all the time and companies very much wanting to sell those products to us. They are going to do research, they're going to promote their products, and there really aren't too many voices to balance those promotional messages.
What about some advice for people who read about the new breakthrough therapies in the paper and see them on TV?
Well, certainly people should be really skeptical of anything that's clearly advertisement. People are not nearly as skeptical as they should be when they see a new medical product advertised on TV or in their favorite magazine. And I guess what we're saying today is that they need to be skeptical even of the news stories, because sometimes those news stories are really no more accurate, no more objective than the ads that they see. So people have to use, you know, I guess common sense, that we know that when we walk into a store, if we try on an outfit and the salesperson says, oh, that looks great on you, we know to be a little skeptical that they might actually just be trying to sell it to us, that maybe it doesn't look so great on us. And we should be just as skeptical when people are talking about, you know, this is a new medical product that'll be really great for you. One thing I should mention is that we often get requests for information about some medical product. What do we think of it? And, of course, we can't have an opinion on every product. The information just may not be available on everything, but whenever we can, we do try to provide information about different products, particularly widely used ones, and people can look on our website for more information, and that's www.centerforpolicy.org. So when people look there, you know, you can look under a topic that interests you and try to find out whether it's hormone replacement therapy or are mammograms really effective, or what about breast implants, or other topics. Check it out.
We've been speaking with Dr. Diana Zuckerman, president of the National Center for Policy Research for Women and Families in Washington, D.C.
The National Center for Policy Research for Women and Families website is at www.centerforpolicy.org. That's www.center4policy.org. Dr. Diana Zuckerman's article, Hype in Health Reporting, is also available on FAIR, the MediaWatch Group website, at www.fair.org. That's www.fair.org.
It was on the Monday morning, I was tired, my head was turning, and I couldn't face the thought of going back to work. And so I paid a visit to the doctor, and he gave me the once over, said, "Don't worry, we'll soon have you on the go. You need
pills, pills, pills and pills, pills to take the pain away. Just smile 2-3 times a day, you'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy, pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do."
So I took the dose as ordered, and my energy was restored. But I was twitching, I was itching, couldn't keep my body still. So I twitched right back to see the quack. "Oh yes," he says, "we'll soon cure that. I'll just prescribe another little pill. You need
pills, pills, pills and pills, pills to take the pain away. Just swallow 2-3 times a day, you'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy, pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do."
Oh well, the twitching soon subsided, then I couldn't open my eyelids. I was dozy, droopy, drowsy. I asked the doctor why. He just took a little look at his new multicolored booklet, then he shook me from my slumber with a cry. "You need
pills, pills, pills and pills, pills to take the pain away. Just swallow 2-3 times a day, you'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy, pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do."
Now my cupboard's overflowing with the pills that keep me going. I've got yellow, pink and orange ones. I can't think what they're for, but they look so reassuring. I suppose they must be curing me. I wonder how I ever coped before or without
pills, pills, pills and pills, pills to take the pain away. Just swallow 2-3 times a day, you'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy, pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill can do.
Now the drug firms are delighted, and they say I should be knighted, cos I keep their profit healthy, and they've got a super plan to launch a major operation to present me to the nation as a fully working model of a well-adjusted man. You need
pills, pills, pills and pills, pills to take the pain away. Just swallow 2-3 times a day, you'll be as good as new. And we've got pills to make you happy, pills to pep you up and calm you down. It's magic what a pill.
Colleen Fuller is an independent health researcher and research associate with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. She is author of Caring for Profit: How Corporations Are Taking Over Canada's Healthcare System, and she's co-founder of PharmaWatch, a Canadian advocacy group for the rights of prescription drug consumers. Colleen Fuller is speaking to us from her home in Vancouver. Hello.
Hi.
So there's a lot of attention, a lot of excitement being generated in the media about gene therapies, genetically based medicines as solutions to a variety of health problems. As a consumer advocate, what are your concerns about gene therapy drugs?
My concerns are around the safety of the drugs and not just whether or not they do what the manufacturers say they're going to do, but what are the long-term health consequences of taking these types of drugs. My own experience, actually, my own personal experience, because I use insulin, and the experience I think that other people are also having is a result of the lack of really thorough research being done on the drugs. There are problems with the drugs that are being reported. My concern is that they're not being thoroughly researched before they're on the market, that the goal of the manufacturers is not the kind of health goal that we would have, but rather how much money they're going to make by selling them.
Now, I understand that there are at least 100 biotech drugs currently on the market. How did they get on the market so quickly?
The first biotech drug, in fact, the first biotech product to ever come onto the market was synthetic insulin, rDNA insulin. And the company that manufactured that drug was Genentech, based in California. And at that time, it was just a rinky-dinky little company. And a lot of the researchers
that were working with Genentech were previously at the University of California. So there was a huge, huge push in the late 70s and early 1980s to get biotechnology into the marketplace, and drugs were the targeted product that would deliver these biotech miracles. And so the goal was not to put good drugs on the market, but to break through on the biotechnology front. Of course, at that time, there was a huge competition between Europe and the United States to become the first, you know, country or the first companies to get into the biotech market because there was so much money to be made. And that really has been the push for all biotech drugs since then. It is not that, you know, we have a lot of purported concern about pain and suffering and diseases and cancer. All these diseases and conditions are really there. But the industry is mainly concerned with establishing a substantial market share and making money, and they are making billions upon billions of dollars from biotech drugs right now.
Why do you think gene-related research gets so much attention as quote-unquote breakthrough discoveries? I mean, these are breathlessly reported in the media. What's the push behind that?
The main push comes from manufacturers who are able to apply really long-term patents on these new biotech drugs so that they can maintain a long-term monopoly on these drugs. And these drugs are also costly. They're not cheap drugs. If you look at some of the drugs, and again, the drug that I'm the most familiar with is insulin. In the mid-1990s in Canada, insulin cost about $11 a bottle, and that is now $23 a bottle. And that is the result of the takeover of the insulin market by a new rDNA product known as, quote-unquote, human insulin. So the cost of biotechnology is driving the cost of drugs up, and it isn't necessarily because the cost of the technology needs to be offset. It is because the pharmaceutical industry sees this as another way to really make massive double-digit profits.
Outside of the costs, what other concerns do you have about people taking drugs derived from genetic engineering?
I don't think that we know enough about what the long-term effects of these types of drugs are. The rules governing clinical trials, a lot of people would argue that they have improved, and you know, I take it that they have improved. But we haven't developed an appropriate framework in which to test these new types of drugs because we don't know really what the effects of these new molecules are. Not only are there drugs that are based on, if you want to describe it as a cloned molecule, in other words, genetically producing a molecule through this process, there are also new molecules and new hormones that have never been in the environment before that are being introduced through biotech drugs. And so we don't really have, I don't think, the knowledge to understand what the effects of the drugs are. So now, after these biotech drugs, you know, as I said, insulin was introduced in 1982, and 20 years later, we are now beginning to see some very serious and what are referred to as mysterious complaints amongst people taking some of the biotech drugs. And so why are these mysteries? To me, if there is a mystery, we should be solving the mystery before we put the drugs on the market.
Now, when you talk about mysterious complaints, are you talking about anemia?
Anemia is one complaint. People who use insulin obviously have a chronic disease, diabetes. And people who are the most likely to use insulin have an autoimmune disease, and that's called type 1 diabetes. These people are experiencing, not everybody experiences the same thing, but there is a significant percentage of people who are experiencing problems with the rDNA insulin that they're using. And nobody is sure why they're experiencing these problems, but the problems are consistent across Canada and, in fact, around the world. So the companies, in my view, are basically in denial about whether or not these problems even exist So what we have is mounting anecdotal evidence that there are problems with this particular product. Some of the problems that are being expressed by people with type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes who are using insulin are similar to problems that are being identified by people who use EPO, which is the drug that you were just describing that is used for anemia. Anemia is an increasing problem amongst diabetics. These are indicators of kidney function problems.
Is there a particular reasoning or a particular link between gene therapy drugs and autoimmune diseases such as diabetes? Is there a reason why they choose to make drugs for these diseases?
They make drugs for people who are going to boost their revenues. That's what it has nothing to do with the type of disease or anything. People with chronic diseases are people who are always going back to use drugs because they need the drugs. So if you have anemia or if you have chronic asthma condition or diabetes or hemophilia and so forth, these are people who will always go back to get the drug that they need to survive. And that's why people with chronic diseases, autoimmune diseases, are a lucrative source of profit for manufacturers. And that's no secret. They would describe it that way themselves.
How would you interpret the regulations governing clinical trials in the area of gene-based therapies?
I don't think that we have a proper set of guidelines and rules governing clinical trials in these areas. The reason that we don't is because we're still looking at these drugs. They're new drugs, even though insulin has been on the market for 20 years, and there have been other drugs, human growth hormone, for example, and other drugs that are derived from our DNA technology. But the fact that we are looking at 20 years down the line with the first biotech drug and looking at mounting problems identified by people who use the drug does suggest that the regular time frame for clinical trials is inadequate. And we also need to look at the numbers of people who should be required to be involved in clinical studies before these drugs are on the market. So we need the trials to go on for a longer period of time, and we also need the drugs to be tested on a much larger population. And that probably is true for a lot of other drugs, whether they're biotech drugs or not. But in the case of biotechnology, we just do not know what the long-term effects are. I don't care what any manufacturer says. They don't know either, and they're not investigating it. And they won't investigate drugs that are already on the market. That's another problem that we have. We have all these biotech drugs that are on the market, and we don't have an adequate system for post-market surveillance in Canada or almost in any country in the world, really. So we are relying more and more and more on anecdotal reports rather than on scientific studies that will tell us what's going on.
So you're saying whether we're dealing with biotech drugs or non-biotech drugs, nothing much is known about problems that can come up?
The clinical trials will indicate some problems that come up, whether a drug is a biotech drug or not a biotech drug, but only if the problems occur within, say, a six-month period. And with a lot of drugs, the problems that are experienced by people who use the drugs don't occur until after they've been on a drug for a year or longer than that, or maybe 2 years. And you're talking about a population that uses a drug constantly, you know, over their lifetimes. Mm-hmm. So if you experience problems with a drug after 18 months or 2 years, that is a big problem because you're planning to use it for the next 50 years possibly.
I would imagine that as we go down the line taking these medications, it becomes more difficult to differentiate between possible adverse effects to a drug and the original disease and, as well, a new kind of biotech-based disease.
That is really, I think, one of the things that we need to investigate a lot more because some of the new types of insulin coming onto the market are linked to edema, for example, which is a condition where your body retains water, and it is often indicative of some kidney malfunction. And the reason that you take insulin or other types of oral medication is to avoid kidney failure. And so if the medication that you're taking is linked to some of these potential problems, what do you do in that case? How do you distinguish between the disease and the problem that may be associated with the drug that you're taking to deal with the disease? You know, this is really awful. The promise of biotechnology is really being pushed by the biopharma industry, that they are going to cure diseases, they are going to ease pain. And for us, those of us who have some questions and concerns about biotechnology and the safety of biotechnology, we have to broaden our own lenses so that we don't take the position that biotechnology in food is unsafe, but biotechnology in drugs may be okay, or biotechnology in fish, or biotechnology in trees, or biotechnology somewhere else. Biotechnology is biotechnology, and so let's look at it as a whole thing rather than distinguishing between whether it's in drugs or food or whatever. That is my view of it. I think that those of us who are working on the drug safety side, that we have to start developing stronger relationships with people who have been working in agriculture and food, and find out what the science is telling them about the restructuring of genetic structures and molecular structures in food and agriculture, and whether that does apply in drugs.
In terms of these drugs, are you suggesting that advocacy on the part of consumers mostly focus on the question of surveillance or release to the market? Or why do we need these drugs in the first place?
I think that the approach for those of us who are involved in this area has to be drug safety. Manufacturers make drugs so that they make money. There is no other reason. They're not there to save our lives. They're not there to cure our disease. They're not there to spare us pain and suffering. They're there to make money, and that is it. And the vehicle through which they do that are the drugs that they make, and that's okay. You know, you recognize that, and that's just the way it is. But the job of the regulator and the job of the politician is to protect us from unethical practices and unsafe drugs that may come onto the market. And so they're the ones that we have to hold accountable. I think we have to hold the corporations accountable through the laws that exist. But we can't say they're bad because they're making money off drugs. We can say that the politicians are falling down on their job because they're not doing the job that they're supposed to do, which is to protect our health. And they really are not doing that. And so I think that one of the things that we have to do as consumer advocates is hold our regulators to account, and the regulator's job is to hold the manufacturers to account. That's partly what we need to do. But you know, what's happening is that the whole system is breaking down, and so more and more consumers are looking at meeting those manufacturers in courts of Canada. That's the only place where they can get any satisfaction. The government is not doing its job, and so they have to do all of the organizing and effort, and really, you know, it's a horrible thing to try to drag a company into a court of law to get some justice done because you've been screwed by their lack of proper study and thorough investigation on a drug that's made it onto the market. We should not have to do that. We should be able to go to our governments and say, we need you to pay attention to this, and government should be doing that, and they're not.
What kinds of court cases are you aware of?
There have been people who are using synthetic insulin who are interested in mounting a class action suit. I think that there will be more and more class action lawsuits against manufacturers.
If people want to get involved in activism around the issue of prescription drugs and drug safety, who can they contact?
Well, there's a couple of organizations in Canada. One of them is PharmaWatch, which is the group that I'm involved with. And the other is the Polaris Institute, which is based in Toronto. And they're not a consumer advocacy group, but they're doing a lot of really good work on biotech drugs and generally on the issue of biotechnology as well. But they're one of the only organizations in Canada which is now really beginning to do some good policy work on the subject of biotechnology and medicine. One of the things that has also contributed to the inability of people to actually know what's going on with these synthetic molecules is that the way that these molecules are made has to do with whether they are safe. The patent is applied to the way that they are made, and so the regulator may know how they're made, but nobody else does. So if you're trying to do anything around these drugs, if you know that there are problems with the drug and you have no idea why, and it's difficult to identify exactly where the problems are occurring, they may be occurring in the process of making the molecules, which is under patent, and so you'll never find out until the patent expires. And this is a huge problem in terms of drug safety. It's not just ownership, it's also a question of actual safety and an independent investigation of the process just to be able to judge whether it's the right process, the wrong process, a safe process, or a process that's going to end up killing people.
You won't be able to help somebody if you don't know where to begin in terms of finding out what's wrong.
You just won't be able to get the information.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we let you go?
Well, I think that one of the things that people should do is find out for themselves what kind of drugs they're taking. There are a lot of people taking rDNA drugs and they don't know. Although people are now beginning to say, what kind of food am I eating? They're not saying, what kind of drug am I taking? And they really should find out. And if there are natural alternatives, if that's what they prefer, they should be making sure that they're taking the kind of drug that they want to take, that it's not a product of rDNA technology if they feel uncomfortable or uneasy about the safety of the technology itself. But if you ask people in an audience who here is taking an rDNA drug, almost nobody would know, even though on the drug it may say rDNA. So people need to really take a look at that to find the natural alternatives, or natural is maybe not the right term, but a non-biotech drug to take if that's what they want to do. And they should also, if they have any problems with the drugs, they should make a note of them, and they should report the problems that they have to Health Canada. And their toll-free number is 1-866-234-2345. 1-866-234-2345. And you'll talk to a health professional or a nurse, most likely. When you report an adverse drug reaction, you don't have to have evidence that the drug is responsible for the reaction that you're having. You just have to suspect that the drug is linked to the reaction that you're having.
PharmaWatch is a nonprofit Canadian advocacy group for people who are experiencing adverse reactions to prescription drugs. Their email address is pharmawatch@pharmawatch.net. That's pharmawatch@pharmawatch.net. Colleen Fuller's book, Caring for Profit, is available through the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Their website is www.policyalternatives.ca. That's www.policyalternatives.ca. And for a close look at how transnational corporations are organizing their push for a biotech future, a report entitled Galloping Gene Giants is available on the Polaris Institute website at www.polarisinstitute.org. That's www.polaris, P-O-L-A-R-I-S, Institute, one word, .org. Next week, consumer advocate Colleen Fuller returns with her colleague Alan Castles. They'll voice their concerns about the push to get new drugs onto the Canadian market as fast as possible. Alan Castles will also explain how to decode misleading claims that turn drug information into drug promotion.
Performed and Dangerous is produced by the Community News Collective at CKUT Radio McGill as part of its award-winning Long-Term Memory Radio series. Our thanks to all of those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. Stay tuned for Long-Term Memory Radio each and every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on Real Audio on the World Wide Web at www.ckut.ca. This 10-part Farmed and Dangerous series is available in a set of CDs from Radio McGill. For more information, please give us a call at area code 514-398-6788 or visit our website at www.ckut.ca and click on Community News. This is Long-Term Memory Radio.
These days one has to stay on top of science and technology. Not easy for a Renaissance romantic such as I, who shies away from medicine. In fact, I am most reticent concerning drugs and docs, but I know why. My father was the same, a man of very simple living. He had only kept two products in his bathroom medicine place. On one shelf, Super Poly Grip for fastening his dentures. On the other shelf was Preparation H. One morning after late night poker, stumbling round his powder room, he needed both. God knows what he was thinking. For what was on one shelf was what he had thought was on the other. And for weeks his lower cheeks were gripped, while all his teeth were shrinking. That one takes a minute to sink in. Now I prefer a naturopath, massage and acupuncture, or a stress-reducing weekend in the waters of Niagara. But the scientists have turned my head, $10 a pop and off to bed, so down the hatch and up you go, Viagra. Viagra, Viagra, Viagra. Incredible, impotent, magic pill. Viagra. 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 For what would not be for now surely will. As good as life can ever get, a grown-up guy's erector set. Demand so high the docs can barely fill. Our glances meet across the bar. We wink and sink and there we are. Don't worry, I confide, I'm on the pill. Things were going really great. I started staying up so late that, like my father, mornings found me stumbling in the loo. But like my daddy did one day, I mixed the bottles up. Oy vey. A different sort of circumstance ensued. It happened at the symphony. My gal and I had gone for free through tickets from a friend in the orchestra. I thought I'd planned ahead so well, until a leaky feeling fell. I realized I'd OD'd on Olestra. 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 A minor side effect is diarrhea. Diarrhea.
Hey, some of you are holding back on that one now. Come on. Let it out.
Diarrhea is not your best friend, even though it comes out okay in the end. I jumped right up, or so I thought, but all my efforts were for naught, for every move I made was in slow motion. And then it hit me like a wall. I mixed them up and mixed them all and chased it with Prozac and Rogaine lotion. My toes were turning stiff and I was struck with oral leakage. I grew hair in places I could not conceive of, so to speak. I cursed my slurry, slothy self and went back to my bathroom shelf and tossed them all away and took a week to clean my system of Viagra, Olestra, diarrhea. Be on your guard, just one more new trick for a really big kick. There are some things you should sometimes disregard, and I never knew that life could be this hard.